The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
All right, we are live. You're not listening to this as we're doing this. We're doing this at 6:30 or so in the evening on Thursday evening. We're live at Chatter at that point, hoping, because it's a nice night, that we make some money and stop this endless slide into poverty at a full-service, for-profit restaurant. We're at the corner here of Jennifer Street Northwest and Wisconsin Avenue Northwest, inside the line that demarks the District of Columbia, the capital of the United States of America, from the state of Maryland. We're joined by Ron Darling, Tracy Roberts already complaining, the most important person in my life, Tracy Roberts, complaining I owe her 10 bucks because she had to park when I told her to park for free on the street, and then said, where's the wine? Where's the wine? We're going to talk to Ron Darling for a whole long time, and until he wants to leave, because he hasn't been asleep in 48 hours. You said something to me that I wrote down the last time we had dinner. I wrote this down, and I thought it could be the beginning. If you ever write an autobiography, this is the first line. I hope I quote it accurately. Okay. My mother is a Buddhist, my father is Presbyterian, and all my friends are Jews. That to me said, I need to know more. Describe your life in those terms. These are seismic moves.
It does sound funny, and I say that all the time to people, and the only reason I say it is because, one, it's accurate and very true, but I grew up in a different kind of house. You know, my mom's Hawaiian Chinese. She spoke the language when I was a kid. My dad's French-Canadian, so he spoke French in the house also. And I've lived in New York City now for 33 years. And if you live in New York City for 33 years, you're going to have a great group of Jewish friends. And I do. And we didn't do it this year. We've tried to do it, and we just haven't figured out when to do it. But we want to do a game with Gary Cohen, Keith Hernandez, my partners for the Mets, mostly in Yiddish.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we want to try to do, it where we use every single term, or, as my Jewish friends tell me, really just have to make up some words to kind of sound Yiddish.
Yeah, that's all you have to do.
That's right.
Yeah. So, but it what it speaks to is the sort of the archetypal melting pot that you start out as one thing, and your moves in this country, it's not the same in Europe. It's not the same in Asia. And this country really does have a history, relatively recent, because it's a new country compared to those countries, of the integration of cultures. And you get influenced by where you live and who's talking to you. And I would think that you could step back and say, wow, because that's the path of my life.
You know what I found so exciting today? When I got in this morning and I had an option of trying to sleep or not, I decided not to because I said, I got to walk around this town. I just love this town. I love walking around this town. And the first thing I notice when I walk around this town is just how different looking everyone is. You walk and you see someone, you know they're from, you know, Africa, and the next person you walk by is someone, you know, who might be Muslim. You know, it's one of the greatest melting pots of all time. And that's kind of how my life has been. You know, I mean, think of it this way, Tony. We saw the cover of Time, or was it Newsweek? I'm not sure. But, you know, in 50 years, everyone's going to look a lot more like me than anyone else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're going to be brown-skinned. And
you know what else is remarkable about that? The culture is transmitted in America by television. The commercial base now shows families of different races and different colors with children as they sell you Cheerios, as they sell you tires, as they sell you pizza. Now, big companies would not do this if they thought it was off-putting or did not represent mainstream America.
It's so true because they've done all the demographics. I find it interesting. I forget what the advertisement was for, but I noticed this stuff just because of who I come from, is that there were two young children, and they were both arguing, and their mother was listening to them. And then when she had to answer the phone or something, they stopped. She answered the phone, and then they went back at it. Both children were Asian children. And it's stuff that you just, when I see it, I'm so cognizant of it.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I'm also old enough to remember that everyone looked like, in the 1950s and 60s, that everyone looked like they were a descendant of Dwight Eisenhower at some point. So it's nice to see.
So you grew up and spent all your formative years in Hawaii before you went to college, or did you move out of Hawaii?
Yeah, I moved out of Hawaii when I was 2 years old, and in fact, that's one of the things that people get all over me about. They're like, how did you move? I'm like, I was 2 years old. I didn't really have a lot to say about
it. Right.
But it was just a basic, my father, who was in the military, got a job in Massachusetts for someone he knew. We moved there. My parents bought a house with a GI loan for $6,000, a ranch-style home in Millbury, Massachusetts, population around 10,000. I just saw my parents a week ago in that same home that they lived in since 1965.
That's great.
It's awesome.
That's great. Because I wondered about the Hawaiian thing, because you are about the same age as Barack Obama. Had you spent your entire youth there, he might have heard of you. You might have heard of him.
That's right. I don't know if I would have been a Punahou guy, because I had, you
that
know.
That was fancy, right?
Punahou's
fancy.
That's like Yale fancy.
Yeah.
You know, it's very fancy.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I would have been a Punahou guy. I probably would have been kind of some of the local high schools that the Hawaiian kids go to. But that would have been pretty cool, because I'm a big admirer, as you know, of President Obama.
Do you have any connections to Hawaii anymore whatsoever? Because the question I would always have for anybody who grew up there or was connected there is, do you feel dislocated because you're not in the mainland of them? It's so far away.
Yeah, you do feel a little dislocated. I think also you get a little bit of that island fever because you're there. The natural grouping of peoples there is so much different than here in the States. I will say, though, if you are from Hawaii and you have Hawaiian blood, you have so much family because everyone's kind of family at some point.
Yeah.
And whenever I go there, if I'm with my mother, she'll say, hey, we're going to go visit this auntie on Monday, this uncle on Tuesday. I'm just like, absolutely not. Tell them to bring their coolers over on Saturday and we'll see them all at one time.
Well, that's the George Clooney movie of 5 or 10 years ago.
Descendants.
It's spectacular. And for somebody like me to see that, I said, oh, my God, they're all of the same family. They're all there.
That's right. It's an amazing place to be. It's an original place to be, which I love originality. I think I like it in places I go. I like it in people that are close to me in my life. And that is one of the most original places. Now, that being said, I was born in Massachusetts. You know, I'm kind of a ham and egger from Massachusetts who now lives in New York for the last 30 years. So I'm more East Coast than the island of Hawaii.
How did you get to Yale?
Boy, that's a great question. Neither of my parents went to high school, or finished high school, I should say. I'm the oldest. All they cared about was one of their oldest sons would go to college. They didn't care what college, that he would just go to college.
Could have been Southern New Hampshire, which has given a doctorate to Bob Ryan.
No, Franklin,
could have been that.
Franklin Pierce, whatever.
Yeah,
it could have been
right.
One of those places. But I don't know. I had from a very young age, and I feel kind of bad when I say this, but it was motivation for me. I grew up in a small town, and all I spent every single moment thinking about is, how the heck do I get out of this town? At some point, I got to do something to get out of this town, and Yale was my ticket.
Did you get in on brains? Did you get in on throwing ability? What do you think? And by the way, you must have, if you were a good baseball player, you had other offers.
Yeah, I did have other offers. I was the kind of athlete that I was a little small for my age. I graduated when I was 16 years old, so I was a little small for my age. So, you know, the Arizona States and those places were not interested. And I also wanted to play two sports in college. I wanted to play football and baseball. And I thought Yale gave me the best chance to do both of those things. Also, I had no idea I was going to be a professional baseball player. I thought I was going to go to Yale, go to graduate school, get an MBA, go to law school or whatever, and then start wearing a suit every day. But it changed. I went from my freshman year, probably about 5'10", 5'11", to my sophomore year, I was almost 6'4". So I was a late bloomer, late grower. So everything I did, which had been very good, I was always a really good athlete, but everything I did now was exponentially better. So I threw the ball harder, I hit it further, I ran faster, all those things. So I went from a a real good athlete to an exceptional one.
But you weren't one of those kids that we have now that are bred through AAU and travel teams to concentrate only on being a professional athlete to make their parents happy.
Yeah, no, just the opposite. In fact, every season, I probably grew up the same way you grew up. Every season, whatever sport was in vogue is what you played. So I was playing hoop in the winter. I was playing football in the fall, baseball in the spring. I also ran track. I enjoyed track at those in those years. So my father always felt, and this is, 45 years ago, he always thought that every sport gave your body a unique chance to develop and develop in a real natural kind of way. And I think because I never spent one day on the disabled list as a baseball player, and it
really?
Probably is because
Strasburg has spent 7 years at this point.
Well, they're a little more careful than they were in my day. They used to cart you out there, whatever, however you felt.
So let me go back to the putting on a suit. What did you think you would be? What was the profession you thought you would get? Because, again, you don't come from people with graduate degrees, and you come from blue collar.
That's right. And I think that's a big thing. I remember I had a friend of mine who interviewed with this real prestigious kind of hedge fund company, and this is a long time ago. And after he didn't get the job, he called them and he talked to the main guy and he said, listen, you know, I just wanted to know, how did the interview go? Why didn't you select me? How come you didn't offer me a job? Because I want to be better next time I do an interview. And the big honcho that he had interviewed with said, well, you know what? Your dad's a post office worker. Your mom's a teacher. And I think you come from amazing people. But you kind of have blue-collar dreams. I need guys who have white-collar dreams. And I thought that was, like, so mean. But also, I think that happens for a lot of kids like me that grew up with a dad who was a foreman in a machine shop for 50 years, is that you feel like you almost, you don't deserve the best that's out there. And but I always felt, not that I deserved the best that was out there, but I had high dreams. I had high dreams. Since I was 5 or 6 years old, my mother, when I was a kid, used to always tell me before I went to sleep, and it's pretty strange, but she used to always say, you're going to be something special. Just know that. You're going to be something special.
So you did not feel unworthy at Yale.
I did not.
You felt I belong here.
I felt like I belong there. And what I wanted to be, there were two things that I wanted to be, and it wasn't an athlete. I wanted to be in 1969. I wanted to be an astronaut. Because we all watched what happened in 1969 with Armstrong and White, and that was my first choice. My dad, who was in the Air Force when I was a kid, told me, "You can't be an astronaut. You're going to be like 6'2". You got to be like 5'8". You can't fit in the cockpit."
Yeah.
I mean, just killed my dreams right there.
Yes.
And then the next one I had, I really wanted to be an architect. I think linearly, mathematically, creatively, I thought that would have been the best thing for me. And if I have another life, and hopefully I do, that's what I would like to do.
I'm going to shift to baseball because people are probably waiting for some baseball questions because you pitched in the majors and you talk about it all the time. What do you remember when I ask what do you remember most about being a player? I really mean that. I don't mean one game.
Mm.
I mean the experience of being a baseball player in the major leagues. What do you remember most?
The things I remember most are the first game I had in the major leagues was September 6, 1983, the 1983 Phillies. Who ended up losing to the Baltimore Orioles that year in the World Series. First hitter I faced was Joe Morgan.
Oh, boy.
Second hitter I faced was Pete Rose. And the third hitter I faced was Mike Schmidt. So I'll remember that forever.
Yeah.
With my parents, there was about 10,000 people at the Big Shea. And I remember seeing my parents. My mom was crying behind the plate before I even threw a pitch. So I remember those things. I remember locker room, you know, the foundation of being any kind of collaborative group, whether you're a baseball team or Friends or Seinfeld, is that that collaborative group at some point, if you're a championship kind of group or a hit show, there's a lot of love in the room for each other because you each have each other's back. I remember that. And then the other thing I think, you know, I hear all the time nowadays, you know, they have these mental skills coaches that help the guys get over and, you know, kind of feel good about themselves and, you know, make sure they don't get down too much because this is a very difficult sport and baseball is based on, you know, a lot of failure. And I understand that, and I think that's great. And I think spiritually these guys are going to be much better than I am at 57 years old. But you know what worked for me is that all the insecurities I have as a person were the driving force behind trying to be successful as a baseball player. The fear of failure worked for me. It wasn't that I felt entitled, that I'm great, that, boy, I have so much talent, I'm going to rock and roll it. I never felt like that. I felt like all those little things that maybe came from growing up in a small town, maybe growing up with a blue-collar family, all those insecurities about, boy, do I really belong here? That's what worked for me and drove me every day to make sure that I never took anything for granted.
The other thing you've got is you're in a team. You're in a room with 25 people at least all the time. I watch this when I watch golfers in Ryder Cup and how much they love Ryder Cup because they're individual athletes and they don't have this. And the womb of a locker room, if you're good at it, can sustain you and float you along for years, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's a real brotherhood in there, or sisterhood, if you're in WNBA or other sports. There's a real brotherhood that happens where you know each other in a way that you never would have known each other. And I think the other thing is that, you know, you're thrown together, and guys from Los Angeles, California are thrown together with a kid from Millbury, Massachusetts, and a kid from Florida. All those different things, I think, to me, really make for how do you get all of these people who should never have met in their entire life are now going to spend the next couple of years together?
So when you look, I mean, I've had the occasion. I was a sports writer for a long time, but it's a long time ago, and I'm not in clubhouses anymore. So now I just look on television,
yeah,
and I see that there are alpha dogs. I look at the Nats, and it's clear to me that Worth and Scherzer are alpha dogs. There's no question about that.
Big time.
It struck me that it might be weird that Scherzer is that because he's a pitcher. You were a pitcher. Mm. Sometimes you're not in the dugout. You're not an everyday player. Is there a discrimination against pitchers? Do you think that you had to prove something to everyday players that you could be a force in a locker room?
Yeah, I think there's different fraternities in baseball. There's the relief pitcher. There's the starting pitcher. And I'm starting at the bottom. So there's the relief pitcher who kind of is in the bottom, their fraternity, the starting pitchers who are in the middle, then maybe the bench players who are a little above that, and then you have the everyday players, the guys that play every day to grind it out. Here in Washington, of course, it's their infield of, you know, Rendon and Murphy and Zimmerman and Bryce when he's not hurt. So that is how it works on a team. How it changes, though, is that a guy like Scherzer gets so much gravitas because not only the awards that he's gotten, two Cy Youngs, but the way he does it. You know, he does it out there like he wants to be one of the nine athletes on the field. There's a lot of pitchers that pitch, and you watch them out there, and, you know, they're really only interested in pitching, really don't want to field, don't want to back up a base, don't even really want to cover first. Scherzer's just the opposite. He is into every single pitch of every single inning, and that's what differentiates
him
from others.
He's top step of the dugout all the time.
He just, I don't know him. I really like him, but I love, you know, his energy is just palpable. You can feel it.
Was there somebody you played with that was like that?
Hernandez was like that. Keith Hernandez was like that. He was just so intense during games that he made you want to be as good as he wanted to be. And I think there's very few people that can lead that way. And it's funny now, I work with him as a broadcaster, and he's a totally different person. He's kind of sweet and nice and kind, and he was like the Prince of Darkness when he played.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's it's great that he's come to that different place, but he inspired because of his he was all in.
This is a very masculine thing to talk about, and I use it in reference to Ben Bradley, who is somebody I adored and idolized.
Of course, yeah.
When Ben Bradley walked in the room, all the other Lions knew that the pride of the Lions had just walked in the room. Was Hernandez that?
Hernandez was like that. When he walked in a room, the room changed a little bit. I've been lucky enough to be in the same room where Bill Clinton walked in. He's a different cat than anyone else who walks in a room.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could be in there with some of the greatest stars, people who are top of the industry, and he walks in and everyone kind of goes, oh, Bill's here. I'll talk to you later.
And you recede.
you
feel yourself receding in their presence.
And you're hoping that maybe he'll shake your hand and say hi.
So you were on World Series winners.
Yes.
You're on one of the most famous teams in baseball. Not so much because of your team, but because of the ball going through the other guy's legs.
That's right.
But it's a World Series win. Were you, with all that, were you as good as you wanted to be? Were you as good as you could have been?
Individually or team?
Individually.
Individually, I think that there are about 100 things that can make you great, and I feel like I did about 22 of them. And I think that goes back to, if you're a perfectionist and you want to do all the things that you want to do on the baseball field, you know, when I see guys like Greg Maddux, who won 355 games, I mean, you know, I won 136 games. That's 200 less games. That's pretty paltry when you look at it. But at the same time,
but it's more than me.
It's
you know, yeah.
It's one of those sports that they always tell you, you are what you're on your baseball card. You look at the back of it, and it says exactly what you did. And are there regrets? Always there are regrets. I think there's many games and years you say, boy, if I had done this or done that, but that's kind of how baseball is. The best part about going to Yale is that when you go to Yale, everyone, you are a great student in your little community or your haven, your village. You're the best student in that vicinity. When you go to Yale, everyone was the best student in their little community. It's the same with baseball. When you go to the major leagues, you were the best athlete that anyone could find wherever you were, within 50, 100 miles. But when you get to Major League Baseball, every guy was the best player of his 50 or 100 miles, and that's what makes it tough.
We're going to take a break. We'll come back with more of Ron Darling, and I'll do a commercial because that's what we should do. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is a Simply Safe ad, and I read, protecting your family is your number one responsibility. Simply Safe Home Security is a great way to do that. The copy says, this is great. I've met Simply Safe's founder, and I haven't, of course. He's mechanically minded and a math kind of guy years back. He's at Harvard in grad school. I'm dealing with a Yalie here, and he's got to hear this. He's at Harvard in grad school when his friends start getting robbed in Boston. They come to him, they say, we can't buy a security system. They have to be hardwired. We don't own our houses. It's a 3-year contract. It's extremely expensive. And he thinks, okay, there's got to be a better way. So he invents Simply Safe. Simply Safe is a totally wireless security system. It's top shelf, complete security with 24/7 alarm monitoring and police dispatch. And with Simply Safe, there are no contracts or hidden fees. You're never locked to the company. Simply Safe's popularity has soared since then. Harvard guys. They're protecting 2 million people now. Check out Simply Safe. You'll get 10% off at simplysafe.com/Tony. Simply Safe, S-M-I-P-L-I, not Y. If you went to Harvard or Yale, you'd know that. Simplysafe.com/Tony. Or if you want your home protected even sooner, like tonight, visit Best Buy. You can buy Simply Safe there. That's simplysafe.com/Tony. Once again, simplysafe.com/Tony.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
All right, we're back with Ron Darling. Tracy has screamed at me during the break to make sure that he talks about TBS. You can talk about TBS.
I am one of those people that when I watch shows, I'm always disappointed when someone has to sell something on the show.
Yes. So I
feel really reluctant to do it.
Okay, good. We'll let Tracy do it. Tracy, you want to get on a microphone? He's doing the Nats and the Cubs series.
Yes.
That's why he's in Washington, D.C. He's going to announce the Nats and the Cubs series.
Well, with Ernie Johnson.
With Ernie Johnson on TBS.
See, so I didn't
okay,
do it.
So
I didn't do
go.
It. You did it.
I did it. Here's a question. At the end of the book, Ball 4, which you may or may not have read.
I have.
Okay.
A couple times.
At the end of the book, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm pretty sure I have this correct because that's carried with me a long time. Leonard Schechter is writing this book with Jim Bouton. And at the end of the book, the narrative goes like this. You think you spent your whole life holding the baseball when you find out the baseball is holding you. This is your whole life. You're announcing. How has this happened?
Yeah.
What is the hold baseball has on you?
It's a great question.
See, Tracy, I got one great one in.
When, you know, we all are retired the same way. There's only a few who are not. Sandy Koufax comes to mind. When you are retired, and I mean retired, You're betrayed by the calendar, and as far as baseball terms are, you pretty much stink at the end of your career. So there's this five-year, I found with most players that are my age, this five-year hiatus where you have to get away from it. You can't watch the game. You can't turn the World Series on. You can't play catch. You don't want to do any of those kind of things because it just keeps, like, Pavlovian, bringing up all these awful kind of images.
That
of,
you weren't good enough anymore.
You weren't good enough anymore. Yeah. And one of the worst things in a clubhouse we were talking about before is that when you're in a clubhouse as a pitcher, your sole place as a starting pitcher is that on each day that you pitch, every fifth day, you give your team the best chance to win. When that mantra is gone, it's about as embarrassing as it gets, because that's when the other players in the room who are much younger than you start looking at you like, old man, why are you here? I mean, you are doing
and
nothing.
And you feel that. You know that.
You feel it, you know it, and you know it's like daggers in your back. So what happened to me is that I had my five-year funereal kind of moment, and someone asked me out of the blue to do a little show in Los Angeles. I said, yes, L.A. for the summer? Yeah, I don't mind doing that. So I went, I started to do it, and what happened, and it was a baseball show, I realized I really love baseball. You know, I felt like I was 8 years old again when, you know, I wouldn't have my birthday cake because Tony C. had been hit on August 19th. My birthday is August 19th. I told my mom, no celebrating the birthday this year until Tony C.'s back in the lineup. Tony Conigliaro. So
I'm old enough to
yeah,
know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I know the picture of his eye.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I saw that.
So so once I started doing it again, I remember I had one of those moments. I said, I forgot how much I love this game.
Were you, as a Yale graduate and a sophisticated New Yorker for so much of your life, was there any moment where you were embarrassed by that love of the game and you said, I can't go back because I just can't. It's baseball. As much as you love it.
I think there is part of that. I think there is part of that where you go, okay, I did that for a long time. Now, I must have higher aspirations for the rest of my life. I should be thinking about maybe owning a big business or running a big company. But you know what? The bottom line is it doesn't matter if I went to Yale or what I've done with my life. I'm a baseball player, and now I'm a baseball announcer. And I can't think of anything that gives me more joy than at some point, and don't tell my employers this, at some point I sit and watch a baseball game, and they send me a check. That's a really good job.
Michael Wilbon has just walked in with his brother Don. Bonnie Burko is here. Wilbon, come sit down. Come sit down. Here, let me get to this, because I'm going to go back in Mets history.
Does he have his Cubs hat on?
Of course he does. So I have this on good authority because I remember reading it. And it was about Tom Seaver. Tom Seaver, a smart guy. You're a smart guy. Tom Seaver, a smart guy.
Real smart.
Tom Seaver said it doesn't pay to be too smart in the locker room. Were you ever resisted? Did you have to change your personality in any way to be one of the boys?
Yeah, I really, in the beginning, I'm a voracious reader, right? So I used to love to read. I took so much guff from it, from the clubhouse guys, that I never read a book again in the clubhouse for the 13, 14 years I was in the clubhouse because guys would, you know, it's a natural thing. Oh, look at the Yaley's reading a book, trying to get himself better. You know, he's better than us, that kind of stuff. So you just...
Well, you're with farm boys.
Well...
You're with people from all over the country.
They're not all farm boys.
Some.
But in baseball, probably at the locker room, you guys know this better than I... The locker room kind of community is you're either in or you're out. There's no in between. There's no trying to be someone different than everyone else. And I decided to do the in part as opposed to be a part.
Well, Seaver, I remember reading this because there was a story by Joe Durso in the New York Times in the late 1960s or early 70s. And Durso was praising him because Durso worked for the New York Times. And he was praising the fact that Tom Seaver did the New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle, and Tom Seaver never did it again.
Well,
exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, the first time I ever met Tom Seaver, it was a like a Thursday afternoon. The New York Times puzzles for people who do them. Monday's the easiest. Saturday's the hardest. Sunday is a fun one to do. He came by my locker through the Times crossword puzzle on my bench and said, kid, I'll see how long it takes you to do this. I had never done a crossword puzzle before. Luckily, I got through it somehow, some way. That made me, he and I close.
That's good.
Which was really
great.
Greatest
pitcher in the history of the franchise.
You know, he's done so much in his career, it's hard to even talk about him. But he invited me over to his house my rookie year. And he said, listen, I got to take a shower. Why don't you go in my library? There's, you know, there's a 69 trophy. There's some Cy Youngs in there, all that stuff. So I'm looking at everything. And they had one drawer, a bureau, that had one of the top drawers was open. So I kind of opened it a little bit. It was just baseballs. And I opened the second one, all baseballs. Like, oh, boy, he saves a lot of baseballs. Afterwards, we had had a couple glasses of wine at dinner. And I got the gumption, the nerve to ask him what that was about. And I said, you know, I was peeking in your bureau there, and you had all lots of baseballs in every drawer. They were all filled. He said, yeah, those are the shutouts.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa.
Yeah. Jump in anytime, Wilbon. Who's the best baseball player you ever saw? Who's the one, the guy who awed you the most where you said, my God, he's in a different species than I'm in?
Yeah, Griffey Jr., I think, was the guy I played against who just, when you looked at him play, everything just seemed to come so easy to him. Everyone else, you know, was kind of plodding along, trying to get it done. But, you know, he did it. He did it with a smile on his face. If he didn't succeed in an at-bat, had nothing to do with his next at-bat. And I remember in 94 when the players were locked out, the last game on the docket that year was the Oakland A's against the Seattle Mariners. I was pitching against Randy Johnson. I got killed early in the game. Junior took me deep for a grand slam home run. And I remember, because it was the last game, everyone from CBS News to anything, every time they showed that the players were locked out, they weren't playing, not going to play the World Series, they showed Griffey Jr. hitting the grand slam off me.
Yeah.
But he was he could do it all. And when he stood in there, it was like, you know, this is going to be a great competition, but not for him. He just it seemed so easy. I'm sure it wasn't, but it seemed so easy.
Who's the best man you ever knew?
Oh, that's a good question. Best man I ever knew probably was Gary Carter. And I didn't appreciate it when I played with him because I think that, you know, he was extreme God-fearing Christian. I think he was, at times it seemed like I didn't appreciate the holier-than-thou part of him. And then I realized as I was getting older that I wanted to be more like him as he was a good father, a good husband, all those things as you get older you try to get better at. So he was probably the best man I've ever been around.
When you were in the majors, I don't think there were as many Latin players as there are now. I think there were more black players than there are now. Is there a language barrier? Is there a cultural barrier? You're thrown together for so long, and if you're not strong as a group, you cannot win. How does that work?
Well, I think for most teams they've found, and I think that if they can get a Latin player who's a veteran player who can kind of be a conduit between, you know, the American players or the Asian players or whatever, I've seen that work very well in a clubhouse. So it doesn't become real separatist where, you know, you have this group here, that group there, and you kind of come together only between the white lines. Well, you know, when I played, it was different. And you're right. There were amazing black players in the 60s, 70s, and 80s when I played, some of the most talented players in the game. And what I always enjoyed about, especially the older black player, I remember Dick Allen used to tell me stories about how different it was for them coming up and how it was difficult to even play sometimes, get on the field. It's just that there was a, and this is kind of an oxymoron, but there was a beautiful hardness to their personality. And I think it's one of the reasons that a lot of the African-American players were so good is because they carried a chip on their shoulder because it was planted there. And that was, I don't know, it was interesting to be around.
Do you have a theory? Because Mike and I talk about this all the time. Yeah. Do you have a theory why there are fewer black players now?
The immediacy of getting paid is one of them, and I don't think that's just to a black player. I think it's to a lot of different athletes. You know, if you're an amazing athlete, I'm thinking about maybe Buxton for the Minnesota Twins. You know, he could be a defensive back, a running back. He could be a basketball player. He could play anything he wanted to play. But if you choose baseball, you're going to go from high school or college, but let's say high school, and you're going to spend 6 years in Des Moines, Mobile, different places like that, and have to get better every single year until they give you a shot. And that's a strong person to do that when you know, if you're a basketball player, you go to Georgetown for a year, be amazing, and then get a huge contract in the pros.
Yeah, the immediacy is it, and basketball rewards immediacy, or immediacy rewards basketball quicker than any other sport. It's a cultural issue, and a sad one at times. I mean, I tell people all the time, I make a living covering basketball. People associate me more with basketball now, even though I've covered everything. And basketball is the only place in American culture, and I mean only. I mean it with other industries included, education, science and technology, journalism, whatever you want to name. Basketball is the place where African-American men have found a meritocracy or the closest thing waiting for them than anything else in the culture. And when you do that, I mean, they're black general managers, former general managers who are now 80 years old from basketball.
That's right.
Not from the other sports,
that's right.
Just from basketball. But I want to ask Ron something, which I guess deals more with, you know, comparing and contrasting. Tell us something that you like more about the game now than when you played, and tell us something that you don't like, dislike more now than when you played about the game.
Well, I guess what I like about the game more is that it seems like, it might not be, but my history is that if you spent an entire year not speaking to the manager or the general manager, that was a great year. That was a fantastic year because they didn't care about you and they just wanted you to do your thing and have no interest in speaking with you. And I think one of the great parts of it, and we're seeing this with Joe Maddon and Torrey Lovello and others, is that Torrey Lovello told me yesterday in a meeting in Phoenix, he said, I said, you know, communication is so important for today's athlete. I said, how have you figured that out? He said, you know what? I just try to do how I was taught. I grew up in a big Italian family, and I tell these players all the time that I love them. Love. That is so interesting.
Did a manager ever tell you that?
Never. And and I also saw as they got all the players on the field, every player gave Torrey Lovello a hug. Can you imagine hugging your manager?
Didn't happen, right?
Never happened. So I think that's one of the great parts of the game is that you really feel there's an open door policy to go in and not only talk about baseball, but maybe even talk about difficulties at home. Or, boy, I'd like to really come in a little later tomorrow. My kid has a piano recital. Or my wife is having a baby. I'm going to take 3 days off to be with her. Those are things that would never happen.
Yeah, Billy Martin, he'd really be welcoming.
Oh, man. Billy Martin, please. Yeah. Wilbon and I talk about this all the time, but you're the source on this.
Okay.
The unwritten rules. The unwritten rules for a pitcher. What are some of those, and are you still with them? I'm sure you had to do them as a pitcher for your teammates, but are you still with them? Is that helping or hurting?
I'm not with them. I've definitely changed on that. Certainly, I was put in a position where someone on our team had been hit or thrown inside to. There was an immediacy to what you had to do, and you couldn't do it like the next game. You had to do it the next pitch. I totally understood that. The street cred that you would get from your ball club if you took care of the players within that ball game was immeasurable. But as I get older and I have children, I know how much damage that baseball can do. And, I remember when I was in the Cape Cod League, and I didn't pitch at all. I mostly played as an infielder, outfielder, the whole summer. It was the greatest summer I ever had playing baseball. They asked me to pitch once, and I pitched in Chatham, which is a very foggy town in Cape Cod, very foggy that night, and a pitch got away and hit a player in the face. And I asked not to pitch the rest of the summer. That's how much it affected me. And, you know, I never wanted to let that happen again. So I never, ever, if I had to deliver a message, I always delivered it from the chest down. Nothing ever higher than that, because I just didn't trust myself. And I just knew I couldn't handle it as a human being if I hit someone in the face when I was intentionally trying to knock them off the plate.
How many pitchers intentionally go high and inside?
Now it doesn't happen that often. A lot of times it's really a mistake by the pitcher. I think they've gotten into a groove where it's very difficult to pitch inside. Guys wear a lot of armor. There's no fear. You know, there was a day when I pitched, if you threw up and in, the guy and his helmet and everything would go flying. That stuff doesn't happen anymore because guys are protected. So they will just lean in and take the pitch and get hit by the pitch. So it's harder for today's pitcher to kind of intimidate the hitter.
I'll go to the sort of code red question. Are these things ordered, or do you just know you have to do it?
I've been in both. When I first came up, you just had to do it. And then later in my career, they were ordered. And what happened at the end of my career is that if our right fielder, who was our best player, got hit, their best player or right fielder got hit. So that was the, you know, eye for an eye that happened later in my career.
But you can't hit the substitute second baseman if they hit your good player.
Yeah, you can't hit Altuve. You know what I mean? You got to hit a bigger guy than that.
Yeah. All right. You also played against cheaters, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
How did you know? What do you think of that?
Well, I always had trouble. I led the league in walks one year, and so I always had trouble throwing the ball over the plate. So cheating is going to make the ball move more. That was something I wasn't interested in. But I did pitch a game where one of the pitchers was cheating. He ends up beating me 1-0. I didn't throw anything but fastballs the entire game. Game lasted about 1 hour and 45 minutes. It beat me 1-0. And I didn't have to throw anything but just fastballs because he put a little beautiful nickel sandpaper size mark on the ball that you could make it dance and sing. It was one of the greatest games I've ever pitched, and I lost because you had so much joy in knowing that I'm only going to throw one pitch. You know what's coming. You have no chance of hitting it. It was like one of the greatest games, the pitching.
When hitters took steroids, did that bother you?
You know, I was probably just when they started to really universally take steroids. When I was ending my career, there were a few guys that were definitely taking it, and it was mostly hitters, not pitchers. By the time I left, both hitters and pitchers were taking it. And does it bother me? It bothers me because it became unfair for me to pitch against those guys. But I understand it. I do understand it. There's just so much money out there. And I'd be very, very shocked that baseball players are not thinking about other ways to skirt the system. Because it's just, you know, if you throw the ball 89, you pitch in AAA. You throw the ball 94, you pitch for the Washington Nationals. There's a big difference in the pay gap there.
When you look at guys like Judge and Stanton, they're just so big. Do you think they, in your head, they must cheat? Or do you say, no, that's who they are. They're just that big.
I think, you know, he was going to be 6'8", whether, you know, he was in shape or not. I think the big difference in today's athlete is that we all played games. These guys, because of the specialization of a lot of them, they are training 12 months a year to be a baseball player. So they look a lot different than if you even look at the uniforms, you know, the Cubs in the 60s, the Mets in the 80s. We all look like these skinny little rats out there playing compared to these guys that have muscles everywhere now. But a lot of it is because the training techniques. I mean, training techniques when I played, they had a bike like in the middle of the locker room. And you'd get on it for 20 minutes. You're like, I had a coach who used to ride the bike after the games and drink beer at the same time. So that was the training techniques.
Right.
And now they are literally going to these camps and schools where everyone like them is training and pushing each other. And that's why they look better than ever.
All right, so what we'll do here is we'll get to the part that Wilbon cares about the most and Tracy cares about the most, and those are the playoffs. Because you're wearing your Cubs hat. And not only are you wearing your Cubs hat, I got your Wrigley Field dirt.
You like the dirt?
Right here. I got the dirt right here. So, Ron, you're going to do the entire series or just one and two?
Entire series.
The entire series, the Mets and the Cubs.
Yes.
The Nats and the Cubs. I see Freudian slip, the Mets and the
there
Cubs.
There you go, that was.
Because I grew up on Long Island.
That's what you'd really like.
You're back to 69.
Yeah,
there you go.
I've got the jacket, the blue and orange jacket from 69.
But he's a traitor, Ron. He's a traitor.
The silk-looking one?
No. The other one, the one that's heavy-looking.
Like a letter jacket.
Yeah, I've got that.
He's a traitor.
No, I've changed my life. I changed my life. I moved.
What life? I moved, too. I moved the same time you moved.
You're stuck in concrete.
No.
You're stuck in concrete.
No, this is what he's done. He's done a LeBron, except it's more embarrassing, because at least LeBron has figured out now, I look like a front-running fool. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to be who I am. Tony has come down here as if New York is Mars, as if it's 8 million miles away.
I still love the Mets, but I like the Nats more.
And how do you do that? How do you give up? How do you turn your back
by the way,
your team?
You know what Mets fans would want me to ask you? That Terry Collins left. Should the GM have left? I'm not even asking you to answer that, but Terry Collins took the heat on that.
Well, let me talk about it in a general way. Okay, so the general managers want it both ways. So they have taken complete control of these teams. They sometimes make out the lineups. They decide who's going to be on the team. At the end of spring training, you don't go to the manager and ask who's going to be on the ball club. You go to the general manager, and he tells you who's going to be in the ball club. So they've taken all of this responsibility. They're in charge of everything, but they still treat it like we're back in 1975, that it's the manager's fault when the team doesn't play well.
Right.
They have it both ways. Right. I don't like that.
All right, so let me get to the series. Nats and Cubs, with the current information – that Scherzer will not start one. I don't know if he will be available for two. It may be three. Strasburg is at one. And as we talked about today, Mike, on the air, Strasburg's last 40 decisions, he's 32-8. But as you know, I have the great fear that if he's the lead dog on the sled, it's not as comfortable as if Scherzer is.
Well, you know, I was lucky. I wasn't the lead dog on the sled. I was behind a guy named Dwight Gooden, who was pretty good in his first couple of years. It does help. It really does because you know, as everyone wants to talk to someone, you can kind of just do your craft and kind of figure it out. That being said, if you look at the Nats and Cubs, they got two interesting issues here, Scherzer and Arrieta. You know, so not that they block each other out, because I think Scherzer in some ways is even more important to the Nationals because of his whole personality and what he does when he's on the mound. But Arrieta is a guy that can, you know, he can no-hit you. I mean, that's how good he is. So those two guys are interesting. But to me, you know, and all that talk I hear from the Cubs saying that they're playing with house money, it's no big deal, we won last year, we'll see what happens, that's all baloney. They can't wait to repeat, and they want to repeat really badly. And they've kind of, and I give a lot of credit to Madden, because they really didn't play a lot of great baseball for the first 3 months of the season. And he just let them kind of figure it out, that there was this malaise from, you know, it wasn't that they won a World Series. It's maybe one of the most iconic World Series in the history of the game. So he let them kind of figure it out for themselves. And the last 2 months, the only team that played better was the Cleveland Indians. So the Chicago Cubs are where they want to be. That being said, this is the best chance the Nationals have had in all the times they've gone to the postseason. They're the most complete. They're the most deep. They have the most pitching, and with the additions of the bullpen, I think this is the premier series. And I don't care. I don't care what's in the championship series, the World Series. I think this is the premier series because they could knock heads for five games. These two teams.
You got a pick?
I got a pick. I think the Nationals are going to do it this time. I do. And I'm sitting next to a guy with a
Cubs hat on.
With a Cubs hat on.
Sitting in front of the Wrigley Field dirt.
But he's already got dirt. He's got a rain.
So you're not, if you're a Nats, because here's what I'm worried about. The last week and a half, that bullpen was terrible for the Nats.
Yeah.
And their main guys were terrible for the Nats. Doolittle and Kinsler, they were terrible for the Nats.
They're terrible. Mattson had some physical issues also. If they're terrible, then the Cubs are going to win in three if they're terrible. I mean, that's because the Nats were they should have been one of the best teams all the baseball all season long. I mean, we should have been talking about them winning 105 games, 110 games if their bullpen. I mean, they blew, what, 14?
Just a lot.
14 games in the first half, something
terrible,
like that.
Just terrible.
But, you know, I just think it's going to be great. I can't wait to
Good.
Do it. Some are different than others. This is one of those series I think is going
to
be special.
One of the things I love about listening to you and Smoltz in broadcasts is that you guys acknowledge, not just acknowledge, but really take listeners, viewers into the emotional aspect of the game, which to me is the most underplayed thing now in this era of analytics where people overstate every single number there is. And I'm saying that to lead into this. Emotions mean so much. And people don't think it means much so much in baseball. They attribute it correctly in football and basketball. But in baseball, to me, and this with the Nationals, are so fragile, and this every year prediction by so many people that they're going to win. If the Cubs beat the Nationals in game one, if they beat Strasburg in
game
one,
it's over.
I expect them, and
it's
I think both teams to some degree know this.
Yeah.
The Cubs have a certain feeling about the Nationals, and they know how good the Nationals are. They do.
Yeah.
Because I've talked to Madden about this during the season, talked to Theo about this during the season, but I think they think that if they can somehow steal game one, even if it's a 2-1 game, and they did this last year with the Giants with the Javi Baez home run, only run, game over. If the Cubs can do that, they're going to feel really, really, really confident about their chances the rest of the way.
The Cubs have the it factor. They really do, and they still have it. And that is, they're the biggest dog in the room. And, the Nationals are going to have to take it from the Cubs. It's not going to be where the Cubs are going to give it to them. The Nationals are going to have to play three amazing games to get three wins to beat the Cubs team. We'll see if it happens. I don't know. Like, when I look at the Nationals, and I see them, 19 times a year, not as many as you guys see them, but when I look at them, it's just their time. And I don't know what they're going to make of it. I really don't, because we've seen it, and you've seen some disappointment before, but they've done it without Strasburg. They've done it without other people. They've got everybody they should have, and it'll be interesting to see if they can do it. And, all these teams are going to have to go through the Cubs at some point they were the best team coming down the stretch.
All right, we're good. I'll read another commercial. Just one last question. Just, I'm sure you've thought of this. Who plays you in the movie of your life?
Who plays me?
Yeah, who plays you?
I don't know. Who's the most Hawaiian-looking guy out there? I don't know. I don't get it. Bruno Mars is a little too short. Dean Cain.
Dean Cain.
Wait, I got a guy, another guy. Who's the guy who's on Hawaii 5-0? He's a character actor on a bunch of things. Tall, great-looking
guy. Dean Cain is
guy.
Hawaiian.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying this other guy is Hawaiian as well.
Oh,
he's
maybe.
On Hawaii 5-0 right now, but he used to be on this show we liked so much where people were half aliens.
Oh, the alien show.
The alien
lasted one season.
Yes.
Yeah.
He was on that show as well. I got to look this guy.
We've done very well on that. Thank you.
Hey, can I tell you one quick Seaver story?
Sure.
Because we talked about him before. Tells you a little bit about pitching. And first, Michael, you were talking about emotion. One of the hardest things to do for these young pitchers, their first time in the postseason, they have to match that emotion and adrenaline with precision. And they're not finding it very easy, are they? It's a very difficult thing to do. Seaver, at the end of his career, Dave Duncan told me this story. Pitching for the White Sox, really the fall of his career. Bases loaded. Harold Baines was up for the Chicago White Sox. Comes out to him, and Duncan says, hey, we got a reliever ready. You done? He goes, no, I got it. So the first pitch, he throws it up and away, not even close, ball one. Duncan looks at La Russa. Second pitch is high, ball two. Looks at La Russa again. What's going on? Next pitch is a changeup, ground up to second. Ball game's over. Afterwards, he sat down with Seaver and said, boy, I was a little afraid there. Those first two pitches weren't even close. He said, well, I had to go to 2-0. If I get to 2-0, I can throw the changeup, and he can't expect it. He'll hit a ground ball. That is pitching at a high art form.
Wow. Tom Seaver.
That's great. That's a great story.
Should I just do this commercial now? This is the Harry's Razor ad. What do you love most about shaving with Harry's, Wilbon? You don't have Harry's. We have to get you a razor. Harry's is so confident that you're going to love their blades. They'll give you their trial shave set for free when you sign up at harrys.com/TonyK. All you have to do is pay for shipping. Harry's is all about a great shave at a fair price, which is why over 3 million guys have switched to Harry's. The copy always says this. Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who were fed up with buying overpriced razors, started Harry's to fix shaving. Now, they're ordinary guys. And the next line in the copy is, they bought their own German factory. with over 100 years of blade-making experience.
Just regular guys.
Yeah, just regular guys. Let's go get a factory. To ensure the highest quality, all products are backed by a 100% quality guarantee. Harry's offers their blades at half the price of the leading five-blade razor, selling directly to you over the internet. To claim your free trial offer from Harry's today, and anybody can do this, it's a $13 value for free when you sign up. You just cover the shipping. You get a weighted ergonomic razor handle. You get five precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade. You get rich lathering shave gel, which I have, which smells good. And you get a travel blade cover. To get this, go to Harry's, HARRYS.com/TonyK right now. That's Harry's.com/TonyK. And before we get out of here, and this is written as well, let me say thank you to Ron Darling for coming on the pop-up show. Let us thank our sponsors. Simply Safe and Harry's Razors. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the Tony Kornheiser Show wherever you listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play. And if you listen to the show through iTunes, please leave us a review. We're getting out of here. We're going inside to Chatter, a full-service restaurant, for profit, and we're eating dinner. Good night.